This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
This is from the Master Wu Men's Gateless Gate, case 23. Think neither good nor evil, the main case. The sixth ancestor was once pursued by the monk Hui Ming. The ancestor, seeing Ming coming, laid the robe and bowl of Bodhidharma on a stone and said, "This robe symbolizes faith. How can it be fought for by force? I'll leave it to you to take it." Ming tried to take up the robe, but it was as immovable as a mountain. He was terrified and hesitated and said, "I've come for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, please teach me, O lay brother." The sixth ancestor said, "Think neither good nor evil. At this very moment, what is the true self of Monk Ming?" At this, Ming was at once enlightened. His whole body was dripping with sweat. With tears, he made a bow and said, "Beside these secret words and meanings, is there any further significance or not?" The ancestor said, "What I've just told you is not secret. If you'll realize your true self, what is secret is in you yourself." Ming said, "Although at Hungrun I followed other monastics in training, I didn't awaken to my true self. Thanks to your instruction, which is to the point, I'm like one who's drunk water and knows for himself whether it's cold or warm. You really are my teacher, lay brother." The ancestor said, "If you are so awakened, both you and I have Hungrun as our teacher. Live up to your attainment with care." The commentary. Of the sixth ancestor, it has to be said that in an emergency, he did something extraordinary. He has a grandmotherly kindness. It's as if he had peeled a fresh lychee, removed its seed, and then put it into your mouth so that you need only swallow it. The poem. You may describe it, but in vain. Picture it, but to no avail. You can never practice it fully. Stop all your groping and maneuvering. There's nowhere to hide the true self. When the world collapses, it is indestructible. So we're concluding today an introductory retreat. We began on Friday, and in presenting this koan, it's a good example of how koans, in particular something like this, sort of appears similar to other kinds of teaching stories in not only in Buddhism but other religions and spiritual traditions, but also how it's different. And so in most traditions, including in Buddhism and by the Buddha's own teaching, you know, he taught by metaphor, by simile. there are images and that represent aspects of our self nature. The moon is often used as a image for enlightenment, weeds for delusion, and so on. And that can be found in virtually all traditions, because it's very powerful. It's a very powerful way of teaching, because everybody loves a story. And so it brings us in to something that is using something out of our ordinary world, our ordinary life, or even an imagined world, but still something that we can sort of enter into. And then it communicates something, right? So it creates a bridge between something ordinary and something beyond our ordinary way of seeing things. The koan is different. The koan is a meditation object, you might say, where in the same way that tanka painting or, you know, different iconographies in Buddhism are not so much created for aesthetic value, although they have that, but so that they can be used in a meditation practice. And so they have a very strong role in helping the student to work with their mind and phenomena to transcend or realize the nature of mind and phenomena. The uniqueness of the koan is that it uses words and language. And here it's using a story. And so the koans are drawn from dialogues, a master to a sangha, between a master and a student, between two masters, ordinary circumstances. They're drawn from many different sources, sutras. But the practice of the koan is that the student takes the essential question that's being raised and puts it into the center of their consciousness so that they're not thinking about it or reflecting on it. They're not trying to figure something out. As Master Dongshan said, they're not trying to answer this question with their mouth or their lips. So although the words have meaning and the meaning are conveying something, that the student isn't sitting in the meaning. They're not trying to discover something through meaning, but actually are using the koan to help them to leap free of that, in a sense, through the meaning, but beyond. And even trying to describe it, right, shows the limitations of language itself. And so that's why it has to be taken up directly. In this koan, this is a very significant story within the Zen tradition. And this is a koan that, while citing historical figures, contemporary scholars believe that, you know, some of this probably didn't happen quite like this. And in terms of the koan, that doesn't matter. Right? Because the point of the koan is not, you know, to verify history. It's to awaken the mind. And so it's not so much the content of the koan as it is the inner meaning, if you will, the inner principle. And so the sixth ancestor was purported to have been a poor, illiterate layman from the southern part of China, which in the northern part of China was considered sort of uneducated, unsophisticated, uncool, primitive. And so here is this, and so he was just a poor, he's said to have cut wood for a living, supporting his mother and himself. And one day in the market, he heard a monk walk by chanting the Diamond Sutra. And some accounts is that he was awakened, some just that he was very drawn to this teaching. And he inquired, you know, where does this come from? He wasn't a Buddhist, so he didn't know much about it. And who knows about this? And so the monk referred him to the fifth ancestor, Hongrun, who was a very well-known master in the north and teaching on East Mountain. And so so the story is, and this is drawing from the Sutra of Huainong, that after he'd made arrangements for his mother's welfare, he took his leave. In less than 30 days, he arrived at Huangmei, which is this monastery where the fifth ancestor was teaching. And the fifth ancestor said, "Who are you from and what are you seeking?" And Huainong said, "Your disciple is a commoner and comes from afar to bow to the master." He cites the town he was from. "He comes from afar and bows to the master, seeking only to be a Buddha, nothing else." The ancestor said, "You are from Lingnan, and you're therefore a barbarian. So how can you become a Buddha?" Huainong said, "Although there are people from the north and people from the south, there is no north or south in Buddha nature. The body of this barbarian and that of the high master are not the same. But what distinction is there in Buddha nature?" And so fifth ancestor, it said, wished to continue the conversation, but seeing his disciples gather, he asked the visitor to follow a group off to work. And Huainong said, "Huainong informs the high master that this disciple's mind constantly produces wisdom and is not separate from self-nature. That itself is a field of blessing. It has not yet been decided what work the high master will instruct me to do." The fifth ancestor said, "Barbarian, your faculties are too sharp. Do not speak any further, but go to the back courtyard." And so he withdrew and was told to split wood and thresh rice. 8 months after this, the ancestor one day suddenly saw him and said, I think these views of yours, your understanding, can be useful, but I fear that evil people may harm you. And for that reason, I have not spoken to you. Do you understand this situation? And Huainong replied, your disciple knew the master's intention, and so I have stayed out of the front hall so that others might not notice. And so the what he's referring to is that because of his low class, his illiteracy, his being not a Buddhist, not even, and not ordained, not from, you know, the sort of culture that the other monastics were from, and yet here he comes with this clarity, engaging in this great teacher, in this very deep understanding of the Dharma, that his Hung Run realizes that this is going to cause trouble. This is not going to be accepted by the other students. And so he puts him away, sort of takes him out of the view. Now, eventually, as the story goes, the master calls everybody together and says, it's time for me to choose a disciple as an heir. And so everyone should write a poem expressing their Dharma understanding, and whoever is most clear will receive the transmission and carry on as the next ancestor. And so everybody backed away because they knew that the head monk would be that person, and because he was the most developed, most senior person there. And so he wrote a poem saying, the body is the tree of Bodhi, enlightenment. The mind is like the stand of a bright mirror. Moment by moment, wipe this mirror carefully. Never let dust collect on it. And seeing that, the master, the Hung Run, praised it and said, let's put it up on the wall so everybody can see it and study it. And Huainong couldn't read, so he asked somebody to read it for him. And he thought, that's a very beautiful poem, but it's not quite, doesn't quite reach it. And so he asked that someone write his poem up on the wall, which read, Bodhi is not originally a tree, nor has the bright mirror any stand. Originally, there is not a single thing, so where could any dust collect? And so everybody gathered, wondering who could have written this poem, and there was a bit of a kerfluffle. And so the fifth ancestor took it down, right? And that evening he went to the rice shed where Huainong was and transmitted the Dharma to him, making him the sixth ancestor, giving him the robe and bowl of Bodhidharma, which had been transmitted from Bodhidharma to that point, and then said, now disappear. Go into the woods, into the mountains, be alone, develop your understanding for some years, 10, 15 years, and when the time is right, emerge, and then you can begin teaching. So that's what he did. So again, how historically correct this is, scholars have opinions about, we're not going to worry about that, because that's not why it's in this collection. That's not why a student takes this koan up. And so, but the koan here, Master Wu Men, has taken just this part of the story and has turned that into a koan. So here he's saying there are certain essential truths that can be realized here. And so in this part of the story, the assembly realizes that the master has transmitted the robe and bowl, and it's not to the head monk. And so who is it to? And so remember the assembly, the monastics at this point were, that the monastic life was one of the sort of higher career paths. And that by and large people came from means, they were well educated, and so it was, and they were monks, they were men, all in this monastery as far as we know. And there was a culture, if you will. And so here's this person who doesn't fit into any of this. He's an outsider, not accepted by this Sangha. And now he has the robe and bowl a Bodhidharma. He is the next ancestor. So there was an uproar. And this monk Ming, Hui Ming, decides that this is not acceptable. This cannot be. And so he sets off to retrieve the robe and bowl. And that's what the koan is taking up. And so normally, part of the story is to convey that the principle that Buddha nature, self nature, is in every person. It has nothing to do with where you come from. It has nothing to do with the color of your skin or your amount of wealth or lack of wealth, your education. It has nothing to do ultimately with, it has nothing to do with being a monastic, being ordained or a lay person, or even being a Buddhist for that matter. That it is within each person. In fact, it's within all things. It's just the nature of each thing. It's the nature of us, you and me. That was the Buddha's realization. That was his liberation. There is nothing to seek outside. There is no flaw. There is no insufficiency, fundamentally. So our experience and our perceptions of incompleteness, of flaws, always having to be based on some standard of measurement, right? Some criteria, right? Which is usually established by those in power. And so when we look at this on a larger level, a social level, a cultural level, we see how those in dominant groups establish what those standards are, right? Establish who has power and who does not, who will make decisions and who will not, who will have access to wealth, access to opportunities and who will not, who ultimately is valued as a human being and who is not. And so, of course, we have our own human legacy of that, going back to the beginning, but we also have our own national legacy of that in the very founding of our country, even before the founding of our country, establishing, discovering America, right? As though peoples had not been living here for millennia. And then the violence and the perpetration of genocide and the establishing of what standards would be established, would hold power. How would things be? And so we can, while this koan is usually presenting Hui Nung as an embodiment, a proof of all of those things that, in a sense, equalize all of us in Buddha nature. That while there are people from the north and people from the south, there is no north or south in Buddha nature. We chant that in the identity of relative and absolute. The mind of the great sage of India, right, was transmitted from west to east. But in the Dharma, there is no northern or southern ancestor. That's what that is referring to, is this very story. He says, the body of the barbarian and that of the high master are not the same. We look different. But also, we could say, one is of high class, one is of not. Maybe one is of light skin and one is of dark skin. Right? One is a monk and one is not. And so those standards of division have to be established in order for there to be the unequal wielding of power, for there to be conflict, for there to be oppression, for there to be the bias and the prejudice and the discriminatory practices that develop and have developed and exist within our culture and that are then infused into our institutions and so on. And so we could look at this also as an example of that, you know. And the consequences of that, he could not stay in that community. He was not allowed. Even though not only did he have Buddha nature, but he realized Buddha nature. He realized the essence of what that whole community was there for. He realized its very purpose. He was a manifestation of its mission. But because he didn't look the way those standards had been had designated a person should look. It could not be. It was not to be allowed. And so, but rather than focusing on what he did not have, you know, in my own growing up in the South and growing up during, you know, being born in the 50s, growing up in the 60s, civil rights, and being very aware of race, being very aware of racism, and the inequities, and the pain and suffering. But it took many, many years, and really more recently, you know, to have my attention brought to the fact that I had been raised within a culture of being white. You know, my attention was always on the inequity towards those who are people of color. And the pain and suffering that was being inflicted by the members of my group, but not really seeing, not really recognizing, not understanding the context, the culture, the world that I had been raised in that gave me access to all of those, through all of those doors, through all of the, to all of that opportunity, right? Which allowed me to think that what I was gaining was really through the my own efforts, right? That because I worked hard, that I rightly received what I got, that that was the work of my own doing rather than that had really been engineered, that my, so quote unquote, my world had been engineered to make that available to me. I still had to work. But it had been engineered specifically so that those doors would be open to me. And so not seeing the deeper levels of that inequity and then my responsibility, because of course, you know, we could turn our attention to the disadvantage of this barbarian, of Huey Nung, and how that affected his life, which is real, but not to the perpetration of that by this religious community whose whole purpose, whole reason for being is to realize the very illusory nature of those very biases. To realize that within Buddha nature there is no high and low and that that is to be manifested in our lives. Otherwise, it's not enlightenment. All suffering is based on the illusion of separateness. The illusion of separateness. So how was it that this whole community and this teacher, to a certain extent, for him to say, you're from the South, you're a barbarian, how can you become a Buddha? Was he just testing him? Or was he actually speaking from that place, right? That place of bias. Even though, as an enlightened being, he would know that Buddha nature was present in Huey Nung, this young man standing before him, he could still be caught and entangled within those cultural views, right? We may think that enlightenment or realization automatically extinguishes all of those deeply held habit patterns of mind. What it does is it helps us to realize that all of those habit patterns are empty. They're mental constructions. They're social constructions. They have no inherent validity. They have no inherent truth. They're not true from any absolute sense. They're only true when someone says it is true and then gets more people to believe it's true and then creates worlds based on that truth, which doesn't make it true. It just makes it a standard by which that illusion is put forward as true. And so that, although that can we can realize that fundamental illusory nature, our deep karma is still functioning within the history, the legacy, the embodiment of that within our deepest consciousness. And that takes a lot of time and effort and the desire to actually root out those deep implanted illusions. So yesterday I went down to the city for this Buddha Action Day, Buddhist Action Day. It was a gathering of Buddhists or a Buddhist who came together to explore the, or to not explore, to set into motion and help create a movement, I guess you would call it, to bring Buddhist teachings and practice, the practice of wisdom and compassion, or as Bhikkhu Bodhi said, solidarity. He said that more and more he thinks in terms of compassion, of solidarity, into the world to address the great moral issues of our time. And that the organizers of this said that a lot of this came through the requests of non-Buddhists, other organizations and clergy who kept asking for the Buddhists to come forward and to present, you know, to be a part, more actively a part of various forms of social action on all kinds of justice issues, to bring forth all the wealth of Buddhist teachings and understanding and practice into this larger effort. And that the Buddhists have gotten, you know, are good at stopping and seeing, right, of reflection, of contemplation, of understanding compassion and manifesting that within our particular worlds, but not so good at bringing it forward into the larger community. And so interesting to me that that call was really coming from other groups and other religious groups, other clergy. And so this group of people put this together, and I was talking to one of the organizers that I'd had meetings with earlier, and he said, yeah, you know, we were hoping to get, you know, maybe 50, maybe 100 if it was really great. He said they got 350 responses, and pretty much all the chairs were full in this very large hall. And so, and the day was really to try and create, come together and form a vision and a structure for actually bringing that forward. So needless to say, it was a large task. but it definitely, there was a lot of great energy, a lot of really good stuff that happened and that will be continuing. And, you know, one of the things that was brought forward, which seemed very important, was, you know, that there are communities that understand that since the election and a lot of the concern that has become very present and a lot of the expressions of divisiveness and hatred and nationalism and racism and misogyny, all of these things that have been coming forth, you know, that there are many people and groups of people who are saying, you know, none of this is new, by the way. You know, this has been going on for years and years. And so we shouldn't be reacting as though this is all just happening, but rather that we need to not just start something, but really be continuing. And maybe more of us who have not been so engaged to become engaged. And so even within our own community, to be looking at, in the same way that Hong Run greeted Hue Nung, you know, how do we greet you? How do we as a community greet we as a community? How do we greet people as they walk in the door? In terms of recognizing that everyone has Buddha nature, everyone experiences suffering, but what we experience as suffering, how we experience it, is quite different. It's quite different. And so when I first came here and was standing in front of the fireplace downstairs on probably the first or second Sunday I'd been here, and I was talking to Dada Roshi, who would become my teacher, and Myotai, who would become Dada Roshi's first heir, and my Dharma sister, and we were just having a, you know, who are you kind of conversation, and much as Hong Run had, And they said, you know, who are you? And, you know, I told a little bit about myself and that I grew up in Georgia. And Myotai, who also grew up down south, but I didn't know that, said, oh, you southern barbarians don't have Buddha nature. You know, you can't become Buddhas. And I'd never heard this story, so I'm like, what? But because of my back, so I didn't know anything. And I thought, well, that's a little like, you know. But because of my background, I didn't think that she was making any kind of, I mean, I knew she was talking about me being a Southerner. But it didn't really bother me, right? Because I had been raised in a culture in which I had basically, that had basically told me in every conceivable way, you belong here. Right? You belong here. And so in that moment, although it was a little questionable, nothing was really challenged in terms of, you know, do I belong here? Here and here. And so to recognize that everyone who comes here is coming from within their own place, which is not just the place of our own creation, but it's a place that is created together and is also imposed on others. For the benefit of some and for the lack of benefit, to put it mildly, for others. And so as a Sangha, what does that mean? And so we're really looking at that, you know? And there's a lot to that that is more than I can speak to in this talk, but is something that we're looking at and we'll be bringing out in terms of, in a sense, the presumptions that might be made, right? Both in terms of the tradition as it has been passed down to us, in terms of this community as being predominantly white, a tradition that has been where the standards have been predominantly defined by men. And so what are those aspects that may not be hidden to some of you, but hidden to others? And those things that are hidden are often hidden to the ones who are making the decisions, the ones who have power. And so to really understand, one of the questions that was being asked yesterday was, why do Buddhists need to be stepping forward? And what is it about being Buddhist that is different or that we have to offer or that we need to be offering, both in what we do and also how we do it? Not because we're special. And that's a whole different kind of thing. You know, that can be a whole different kind of arrogance. But rather, just because of the nature of this practice, of these teachings, of what we're actually trying to do and be and create. And so, Hui Ming going to retrieve the robe and bowl was outraged. He had a very righteous mind. He was setting out to make right what had been wronged. His thoughts, his ideas, his beliefs were all in alignment to explain his anger as righteous. Because, of course, that's what we do. We're never angry for the wrong reason. We're always justifiably angry, right? And the more justified we are in it, the more rigid that anger becomes. He wasn't acting on behalf of his teacher, clearly. He wasn't acting on behalf of the Dharma, although he may have thought he was, or the Sangha. Ultimately, he was satisfying his own desires. But that mind, that righteousness, of course, conceals all of that, conveniently. So that we're freed, in a sense, within our entrapment, to continue trying to align the world in the way that affirms, right, not just this sense of self, but the sense of the way the world is supposed to be. This was not the way the world was supposed to be. Didn't fit. Hui Nung was not the person that was supposed to receive this robe and bowl. It didn't fit. He was an outsider. And that had much less to do with Hui Nung than it had to do with Hui Ming, his world, his mind. What was being threatened? What was he in danger of losing? And so when he encounters Hui Nung, Hui Nung stops. and puts the robe and bowl on a stone and says, this cannot be fought for. It was given to me in faith. It is faith itself. So I leave it to you to take it. And so this is a very nice example of how might a Buddhist practitioner meet opposition. Right? He didn't run away. He met him with a kind of force, but a force of clarity. Right? A force of understanding. Not just understanding his own realization, but understanding this mind, understanding this anger, this righteousness. He said, I leave it for you. You have brought yourself here. You have created this world. I leave this world to you to do with it what you will. All aggression is based on assumption in the self, right? So Hui Ming thought that if he took this robe and bowl, he would have recovered what had been lost. And that this moment is really the great moment of this koan. Right? This great force. It said that he might have been a military general. So we can just imagine all of that in this. The conviction, the strength, the capacity, the power. And in that moment, it said, he tried to pick it up and it was as immovable as a mountain. It's just a piece of cloth. What was happening? What world was collapsing in that moment? What confidence that he might have understood as truth or strength was crumbling and becoming doubt? It's an extraordinary moment. And in that moment, and it's because really what happens next, you know, which is that he has an insight, he has a realization, is of course significant, but this moment is actually the more important moment. Because this is the moment that makes everything else possible. And in the commentary, Shibayama says, even though he touched the robe and bowl as they lay there on the stone, in his emotional agitation, he could not lift them up. Hesitating and trembling, he just stood there. This unexpected impulse, spiritual impulse, must have thrown this sincere and forthright Ming into the abyss of great doubt. His ego-centered and enraged self was at once smashed. This inner conversion, which fundamentally changed something within him, was the most important moment in his whole life. This inner conversion. You can't contrive that. You can't manufacture it. You can't predict it. Right? It's a result of our karma. It's a result of searching. It's a result of allowing ourselves that within that righteousness, there was enough of an opening. Right? There was enough space that when his force was met with the strength of the peace of Hui Ming, that it was like a collision with himself. And the whole world turned in that. And he said, I didn't come here for the robe. I came here for the Dharma. Please teach me, O lay master. And so Hui Ming simply responds, having arrived filled with thoughts of good and evil, let go of all of that. At this very moment, who is Monk Ming? Who are you? And at that moment, he realized it, self-nature. At that moment, there was no measurement of time, of place. There was no sense of past and future. He had forgotten what he came for. He had remembered what he came for. at that moment, all of that clinging, all of that baggage, all of that entrapment that was being othered, that was being externalized. There was nobody left to blame. He was left alone. And in that complete solitude, he realized there is no north and south. There is no high and low. And in that moment, he becomes a student. Or rather, he reclaims his student. And that's another extraordinary thing about this, is that nothing is absolute. No one is absolutely pure or absolutely evil, absolutely right or absolutely wrong. One of the people at the conference yesterday talked about, you know, in going to a lot of different, you know, groups that are being very active, doing very good work, you know, very progressive work. He said that so much of the time he sees people in this group meeting the intolerance of the people and the views and the beliefs and so on that they're trying to shift with intolerance. And he said he recognizes that that can't work. It's not going to work. That's not a viable path. But how to care so deeply, how to meet the creation of suffering, real suffering, and the powers of that, those who are in those positions, without recreating that within ourselves. That's one of the greatest challenges, I think, of all of us, of people, not just Buddhists, that if we actually take these teachings seriously, really the teachings of any religious tradition, then we ourselves will be the greatest challenge. We ourselves will have to wrestle with that dragon. And so, because I've run out of time, I just wanted to, I wasn't here when we, when I was away when we celebrated Martin Luther King's Day. And so I wanted to invoke his wise and loving words in terms of the beloved community. We speak of Sangha, the virtue of harmony, of noble friends. And this Sangha is understood as the community of practitioners, those who are here today in this hall, our larger community within our Sangha, those who are not here today, and all beings, those who are not here today. And recognize those who would want to be here and can't be for various reasons. And those who would not want to be and aren't for various reasons. And that all of that is Sangha, all of that is this beloved community. And Martin Luther King Jr. said, the end of is reconciliation, the end is redemption. The end is the creation of the beloved community. And I would say the path, that what we're practicing, what we're bringing forth, that has no end, in fact, that challenge that we face, our imperative, what Dada Roshi used to call our spiritual imperative, is this. And he says it's a type of this type of spirit, this kind of love, is can transform opposers into friends, can dissolve dualities into unity. This type of love that I stress here is not eros, it's not an aesthetic or romantic love. It's not philia, sort of reciprocal love, what we do for each other, that of personal friends, but it's agape, which is understanding the goodwill for all people. It's an overflowing love which seeks nothing in return, objectless compassion, goalless compassion, which has a very clear path to alleviate suffering, but without fixation on the goal. It is the love of God or the realization of Buddha nature working in the lives of people, you and me, our Sangha, other communities. This is the love that may well be the salvation of our civilization. I would say that a little bit more emphatically. This is the love, the compassion, the solidarity that must be the salvation of our civilization. Why? Because it's our nature. It's not just because we know that this will lead us to a path of equality and justice, where it will lead us to swords into plowshares. But because it is our very nature, and until we live in harmony with our nature, how could we possibly hope to live in harmony? The very definition of harmony is alignment, is unity. And so in that way, Buddhism goes far beyond Buddhists and Buddhist communities. And that any step, any action that moves towards rather than away, that calms rather than agitates, even if agitation is the path towards ultimate calming, right? Sometimes you have to raise some hell in order to move towards calming. But can you do that without hatred in your heart? That's the great challenge. Can we hold those ourselves and others who are creating suffering accountable without ill will? And that is the greatest demand of all. It's easy to bring forth and be motivated by hatred and anger. Right? That doesn't take a lot. But that does not set us on the path of what Martin Luther King called salvation, which we call the realization of our birthright. And so that's really why we exist here. That's why the Buddha Dharma was brought forth into the world. That's why the Buddha taught throughout his life, rather than just living in a secluded, quiet life in the woods. Right? It's for that, for the realization of our potential as not just individuals, but as a whole human community, the enlightenment of beings. And so for us to be dedicated to that in our own lives, whether it's a Buddhist path or not, those of you who are here for the weekend, whatever, wherever our lives are, to be creating that beloved community, what better way to spend a life? What better offering to offer? So, you'll need a little bit of courage and perseverance and patience and trust and faith. Right. And joy. Joy is a good thing to bring with you too. And that when we gather together to practice, even in facing what is difficult to face, in ourselves and in our world, that inevitably joy is brought forth. Why? Because we're moving more in alignment. Right? Because those gaps are closing. And so this is our time, truly. This, I really feel like, is the time that we are in. It is the fierce urgency of now. It's the great Dr. King spoke of. And so let us each in our own way and together take this up, continue this, and be inspired, and inspire each other. It's a long path, but it's a true path.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the Monastery Store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.